This is Keep Talking with Greg Rennie and Rob Reiford on Mind Body Matters.
The unmistakable sound of lead vocalist Brian Vollmer from Helix. And Brian is with us today on Mind Body Matters. Such a pleasure again, my old friend. How are you?
Nice to be here, Rob.
We've reached you at your, let's call it your winter home in Florida.
In North Fort Myers.
Yeah. How's that going? Brian, you've had that home for a bit.
Well, we actually started coming down here because my wife had lung problems, and so we wanted to get out of the Canadian winter. We came down here, we rented for about 4 years, and then the people that we rented from decided to retire, and we thought they were going to come down here and live in the house that we were living in. So we looked around, and we ended up finding the place we're in now. I'm very happy to be here.
So how many months a year do you stay at your place in Florida?
Almost six. We consider ourselves very lucky to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It does take a bit of money to come down here and run two places at once.
I'd like to say the last time I saw you was about, I'm going to say, 5 years ago in your backyard in London, Ontario. That day we had Chris from Helix along with our departed friend, Greg Hines, and yourself in your backyard. We had lit a fire and we were telling stories around that fire.
Yes, we had many good times at the back of that property and as around that fire, like you said. We used to have record release parties at that house. The backyard fires always brought people like the Mudmen. I think Ronnie Hawkins' son came one night and sat around the fire. The Killer Dwarfs, all sorts of bands. I only live across the fire lane now, so I'm not that far away from it, only I don't have to paint it anymore or cut the hedges.
I have to tell people about your old house in London just before you moved. You've been into your new house in London now for what, I'm going to guess, about 3 years?
I think about 3 years.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a new house, though. It was actually one of our rental properties, and we just moved across the fire lane into that rental property.
How is the old house looking now, Brian? I have to admit, any time I went over to your place in London, Ontario, it was like a shrine of Helix. It was like a museum.
Well, all that stuff got shipped off to the University of Toronto. I went and took the stuff out of just one closet in the basement, and I shipped it off a couple of years ago, and they gave me a tax deduction. They don't actually give you money for the stuff, but it was a considerable tax deduction. But after all, Helix was the first real heavy metal band to come out of Canada, and we were also first in a lot of other things in Canadian music history that people might not know. And one of the things is that we were the first Canadian band ever to play from the Atlantic to Pacific through the bars. And I lean on that in conversations because I think that is important.
You've also got a book about your scene touring the bars.
Well, the first book I have out called Give Me an R, which I released some years ago, talks about that. But I was going to actually write a book about the actual bar scene, how it came about and why it ended and how it was good and how it's missed. But life got in the way over the last couple of years. You know, my mother died, then the Hurricane Ian hit here and tore apart North Fort Myers, and Fritz got cancer, and holy cow, the world went freaking crazy with COVID. People lost their freaking minds.
The shit hit the fan, my friend.
The shit hit the fan. I'm still talking to people, and they're going, yeah, I'm really sorry I talked to you like that, or I'm saying that to them, right? And I just put it down as COVID craziness. Should be a song.
Greg and I have talked about COVID on our podcast last little while. Brian, you had talked about the bar scene. It's no longer existent. Do you really believe that? I actually believe that. The bar scene isn't, like, you can't go out to bars now and check out some great bands like we used to.
Well, and people don't follow bands either. They don't travel from town to town. A lot of that has to do with drinking and driving laws, and just the fact that there's so many more, much more ways to be entertained than there was back in 1974 when we started on the bar circuit.
Yeah.
It's a different way to develop music nowadays. If you follow the Grammys, they have like 25 different writers on one song. You go, how the hell does that happen? Well, easy. You got three writers. You bring in three hit writers for the artist, right? And then you get a beat person, and then a person that does samples, and a person does this, a person that does that, a person that wipes the artist's ass, and next thing you got a hit song. and they're all in there as a writer. And they even changed the work permit application for the states, because I noticed for the first time they ask if you're going to go down to the United States to write. And I go, what? I phoned up the musician gene. I said, are you telling me if I go down, I'm staying in Florida, I just happen to be over at a friend's place, he's a musician, he picks up a guitar, and suddenly we get this idea for a song that it's against the law for us to write the song? And the musician gene guy went, well, technically, yes. I go, that's fucking retarded. Excuse my French.
That's all right. The F word's allowed on this podcast. You had mentioned it's been a tough couple of years, not only for you, but for all of us with COVID and all that. You've lost your mother. One of the things I wanted to cover tonight, Brian, as we speak, is Helix has had a couple of great losses over the years. I go back to the days of Paul Hackman. In that tragic accident in the van out on the West Coast, and then of course our lovely departed friend, and I call him a friend because this guy next to you I thought was the personality behind Helix, and that's our drummer friend Greg Hines, Fritz.
Well, everybody was a personality in the band, but we all had different personalities, and Fritz's personality was out of Helix's David Lee Roth. The most frequent question I got on the Quiet Riot Whitesnake tour when I went out to the buses every day from the contingent of scantily clad women hanging out at the buses was, do you know where your drummer is? I go, no, I don't. But I would imagine he's either in the bus or inside.
Now, speaking of which, I know Greg wanted to ask this question. Let's go back to your days when you were out doing, I think it was a tour or it was a promotional tour or whatever it was, out in California, and you actually ran into people like Robin Williams. You ran into, who else, Greg?
Well, actually, I want to hear the story about Tracy Lords first before we get into Richard Pryor.
Well, let me hear the complete story.
How did she fit into all this, Brian?
Well, we were flown out to Hollywood to do a video, rather, with, I forget who the producer was, but it involved all these girls from We Magazine, Penthouse, Playboy, and Tracy Lords, who I'd never heard of because I don't watch porn films.
I kind of know her.
Okay, you kind of know
what
her.
What do you mean you kind of know her?
Yeah, you kind of know her. And, well, anyway, I'd never heard of her before. And all the girls on the set are saying the slut. And I'm going, the slut? Who's the slut? Well, it turned out to be Tracy Lords. That's who they were talking about. And she was only 15, which I also didn't know, which would make her underage. And that video's still out there, that topless one with her in it. I filmed most of that day on my movie camera, to tell you the truth. But Robin Williams, Richard Pryor, and Rip Taylor all came over that day. They were next door filming Pryor's Place, the kids' show. And you could see where Pryor had blown up his face with the freebasing. And Robin Williams was there, and he did a little skit for me and Rip Taylor. And Rip Taylor got in the end of the video. And when we went to look into the paperwork to actually allow him to be there, like with his agent and everything, it was so much bullshit, we just went out, put it in, and we did.
I want to make mention, too, one thing I've always admired about you, Brian, is your ability to follow the action with your, I think, what do you call it, a 16, 18-millimeter camera?
Well, I started out with a Super 8 camera way back.
Okay, yeah, way back when.
And I wasn't really a technical guy. In fact, a lot of film I ruined because I didn't know what the hell I was doing, right? But I loved taking pictures. I got it from my grandfather. A lot of things that I ended up doing in life from drawing pictures, the singing songs, all that stuff was because of my grandfather. He was a big influence on me. And my, you know, but all the people in my life, my father, my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, they were very strong people in my life. They were good people and they influenced me greatly, all of them. And from my grandfather, though, I got the music and the camera. My grandfather had one of the earliest, you know, silent cameras where you used to get the film where there was like 3 minutes and 20 seconds and you had to put it in a little canister and send it off to Kodak all taped up. And then you got it back and there was like three quarters would be like white and you go, what happened? And you never find out.
You've got tons and tons and tons of footage about the band. And I know that you've been trying to digitally master a lot of this stuff recently because you and I have talked about that. It must take you back, though, when you look back at some of the earlier film of Helix.
Well, I can remember a lot of this stuff just like it was yesterday. It doesn't really seem as long ago as it really is.
So you used to go out and record. I remember one video, you and Paul Hackman. Paul was saying, well, we're waiting for the rest of the band to show up. Brian's here, but the rest of the band isn't here. And that was out at Sipes Barn in Baden.
That's right. I used to have more to that film, and somehow I lost it. Brian Derner shows up really late. Then some dog starts chasing his bike. He was a real kind of biker dude. And I don't know where the dog came from, but he kicks the dog in the head as the dog tries to kind of bite him in the leg as he comes in. I don't know what happened to that piece of film. And Bert was constantly late. He couldn't be at the time of his life depending on it.
Just getting back to Fritz just for a moment, Brian. Can I ask personally, what were your last words to Fritz before he passed on?
Well, I went and saw Fritz, and we had a private moment about, I don't know, a month before he passed away. We knew he was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
We were like brothers. In fact, I told my old brother, I said, look, I spent more time with this guy than I spent with you. We lived together in a bus. Through all the 80s, we were, you know, 3 feet apart. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And same thing in the 90s. And then he came back and we were always a tight group. We were always very close. We loved each other a lot. You know, I believe it started to happen after he had his
fall
a couple of years ago. He was lucky to have survived that. People don't realize, but he fell
off his roof.
I don't know, 8 or 10 feet, and he landed on his head on the cement sidewalk, and he came back 6 months later. And he came back so early, in fact, that I had booked flights, and I had to literally, you know, flush what I paid on the flights because I never in a million years expected him to come back. He was so damaged. He broke his back, his ribs, and... you know, I don't want to dwell on it because I know he didn't like me talking about his injuries, but he was severely injured. And I only mentioned it before because I thought he was such a warrior to come back. But, you know, Fritz was such a humble guy. When I'd talk about it, he didn't like it. He didn't like the attention it drew to him, so I shut my mouth up after that.
Brian, I called you approximately 3 days after Fritz had passed on, and you and I had a... really good conversation that day. You were on your way in to do a gig or something in Ontario. You had said to me, and it's something that will always stick with me about Fritz, he was Canada's best heavy metal drummer.
And he sure was. People don't realize how good of a drummer he was. He was very unique in his playing style. And he was a great performer live. Great showman. You know, the Junos just asked me for a picture for him. I guess they have an obituary thing during the Juno Awards every year. And I sent them the picture of him on stage in his studded codpiece. He used to wear it on stage, right? And it used to be a big deal when he'd come out at the end of his drum solo. He'd have these little knitted socks on and this studded codpiece and nothing else. And the women go crazy because they just loved him. And anyway, there was a picture of him walking out and he's got his hand extended as if he's going to shake the audience's hand. But that was typical Fritz. And I thought that picture really summed up what he was like character-wise. He was a funny guy. He enjoyed life to the fullest.
Yes.
And he was, I'm pretty anal sometimes, uptight, because I'm the boss, right?
Yep.
You know, he was the exact opposite of that. He was like, and he was funny. And he's going to be missed.
He will. Now, with the departure of Fritz, where does this leave the band? I will mention some upcoming touring dates. I believe you've got something going on in down in Illinois in May.
We're pulling Chicago May 11th with Honeymoon Suite, and then the very next weekend we're in Edmonton, Alberta at the
River Cree Resort and Casino.
Oh, yeah, that's it. And Alda Nova was opening for us that night.
That's right. I haven't seen Alda Nova in years. So Honeymoon Suite, May 11th, 2024.
One of the very next weekend in Edmonton, Alberta.
Right on.
And I got to start rolling some other dates in later on the year. But getting back to Fritz.
So obviously he has to be replaced. And can I ask who is going to replace Fritz?
Well, it's
going to
be Jamie. It was Jamie before when he was off.
Okay.
Jamie Kontz had come from Sire. We came from the same stable of bands that were under the management of Bill Sipe. But the first gig that Jamie went to, like to see a big rock band, was to see Helix. And
wow.
That's when Jamie decided, after seeing Fritz play, that he was going to be a drummer. That's what he wanted to do all his life. And he, guess what?
Wow.
He's still a drummer today, and he's drumming for Helix.
So Fritz was this guy's inspiration.
That's right. In fact, it was like one time he saw him, and that was it. Changed his life.
Wow. Greg, you had a couple questions for Brian.
Yeah, Brian, you can see I'm wearing my Capitol Records t-shirt here.
Is this good?
Is that good memory or bad memory looking at the logo?
I'm just joking. There was a lot of good people at Capitol Records. I think that I miss big record companies because big record companies were the bank. And I think that's, you know, the music business is very splintered nowadays. And I don't know whether you're selling music or a clothing line.
Well, that's the thing. Like at one time, Helix had the record contract with Capitol Records way back when.
It was actually Capitol EMI USA.
That's right. It was a U.S. contract, was it not?
I was also EMI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the guys at EMI the EMI reps used to say that the letter stood for every mistake imaginable. That was the record company, not me. Record company said that.
So what I understand, Brian, is that Attic Records came to you guys and you passed them down, and they were kind of pissed off you passed them down.
Well, I think that, yeah, he was offended when I said that, but it was true. I remember back then. Attic offered us a deal, and I believe Lee Aaron and Killer Dwarfs. And we looked at it and we went, well, where are we going to make money here? And we said no.
Mm-hmm.
And like we actually did the math on it. We're going, okay, we sold X amount of records. How much did we get? We went, well, that sucks. We thought that it was much more advantageous to us to try to get signed to a major label, first off. And then it was actually Dean Cameron who got us signed to the American label. It was Dean Cameron that thought that if we were with the Canadian label, we wouldn't get the money that we needed to break internationally. And so it was Dean Cameron, the president of Canadian Capitol, that actually got us signed to the American label. And we were never, ever signed to the Canadian label. We were licensed through Capitol Canada, but never signed to them.
Is that why you guys were more popular in the States than Canada, or what was the appeal down there compared up here?
Yeah, the appeal down there was because we went down there and played. The problem with bands back then at that time is they got spoiled by playing in Canada. They'd become huge in Canada, and they start making this huge money. Well, it's like everything else. You rise to your level of income. So all of a sudden, you got all these band members making big money in bands. They didn't want to start all over by playing for, I don't know, $1,000 a night or $800 a night in the States.
Right.
But guess what? We would. Rush would.
Right.
We looked at Rush as a model of what we aspired to. And Rush was out there doing, like, I think at one time they did 73 one-nighters in a row.
Holy shit.
So we were out there. We did 39. We got, you know, not 72, but we got 39 in a row. We started off somewhere in, I don't know, it was like Louisville, Kentucky, and we ended up in Minneapolis.
These days, Brian, is it safe to say most of the musicians out there are, let's call it private enterprise. They're promoting their own stuff. It's indie as opposed to having the big record companies behind them.
For sure.
That's how you're doing your business model now. Am I correct?
That's right. A lot of smaller bands like Helix can actually make a living doing this. We play a lot less, mind you. And it's a constant job just to keep our band in the public eye without being forgotten. Music moves along very quickly, and you have to grow along with it very quickly. It was John Lennon that once said, either you grow with music or music outgrows you. It's very true. And so we're looking at pumping the show up, perhaps with audiovisual effects, bringing an LED screen behind us. They look awesome. Then you can put up film. You were talking about film. Well, we have 100 hours of film, whatever, right? So we can definitely enhance the show with some like an LED screen behind us.
Right.
But it takes time to put together the opening film, to plot out the show, to know exactly what you're doing. Some of the stuff has to be choreographed. In other words, you have to sync track it with the film and the drums, because the sound and the film have to move at the same speed, right?
Yeah.
You keep going forward, and I don't really have a secret in a box somewhere that I can pull out. I just hope that if I do my best, somehow, some way, things keep moving forward. It's the 50th year for the band this year, and I still feel pretty good physically, and my voice feels pretty good.
Is it 5-0 this coming year?
50? Yeah, we're 5-0 now, yeah.
50 years.
Oh, half a century.
You had mentioned that you're still in physically good shape. One question Greg always asks on Mind Body Matters. We usually do it at the beginning of the show, but I'm going to ask you the question now, Brian. In Mind Body Matters, we always ask, what does the mind-body connection mean to you?
Everything. There's a book I got. Where the hell is it? Or let it be right out here. I got this book at a flea market. You know, I don't think anything happens by accident. It's an old book.
Oh, I
agree. You see it?
Key to Yourself.
Written by Dr. Venice Bloodworth. Look it up. Anyway, it's all about how everything begins in your mind and your health. Because when you think health, when you visualize, you meditate in yourself healthy in your mind, your mind has to, or your body has to follow your mind's command. And so the secret of good health is to frequently visualize yourself in good health and back it up with proper eating habits and exercise. And probably, you know, probably to add to that, being in a good spiritual space as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, mind, body, spirit, for right, sure. Yeah. It just seems every time I end up talking to Brian on the phone, he's usually either starting or finishing a walk. I always get you on the phone. No, but you walk every day. Am I correct, Brian?
I walk every day. I try to do at least 10,000, but I'm trying to get up to 20,000 a day. That's about 10 miles. But that allows me to eat like, I think, 900 extra calories a day.
Yeah. So earlier you were saying that your voice is in good shape. I'm wondering, have you done anything to keep it in good shape over the years?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I was told in 1976 I'd never sing again, so I went for voice lessons from Ed Johnson, who taught me the art of bel canto. I'm one of the last teachers in the world to teach true bel canto.
Oh.
Started by Leonardo da Vinci.
No kidding.
And passed down to the greatest voices in history. And I'm one of the few people that teach it.
Brian's been teaching bel canto for years after he learned
it. I've studied for years and years and years.
In a nutshell, Brian, can you just describe what bel canto is?
It means beautiful voice in Italian, bel voce.
Okay.
It's the way the greatest singers in the world sing, and it's based on four steps. Lift the throat, aiming at the mask of the face for resonance and projection. Inhalation, the act of drawing breath into your head as you're singing, and the hold of the breath, which is holding the diaphragm in a lowered state and letting the intercostal muscles squeeze the lungs from the sides, not from the bottom.
So you credit Bel Canto for helping you out over the years and still maintaining your voice today.
Oh, for sure. All these singers are losing their voice. They're losing because they have tension around the thyroid cartilage. Every single one of them. And the ones that get operated on, they're doomed. They can't go back.
Would that prevent the ruining the voice? Because a lot of singers talk about ruining their voice in time. This method would prevent that?
Sure would. Because all that polyps or nodes are is calluses. The reason you get calluses or polyps when you sing is because of the tension around the thyroid cartilage right here, especially in high notes, which vibrate at a faster frequency and therefore require more breath and more pushing. Most singers push. In fact,
okay.
The common phrase to hear the singer was in town and really belted out the song, right? But the problem with that is when you belt your voice, you have to use muscles around the thyroid cartilage. It's impossible to push without using muscles. And to add to that, you eliminate the overtones of the voice because you're pushing the breath out of your mouth before it gets a chance to resonate in the sinuses, which in turn vibrate down through the hard tissues of the neck into the chest for the bottom part of the note as well. So you're left with a mid part of the voice, which is called the yell of the voice. And there's a reason for that, because it sounds like a yell. A singing voice includes three areas of the voice, highs, mids, and lows. So when you push, you eliminate the overtones. You eliminate the highs and lows. That's why you got singers like Ethel Merman. Just one of those big, bellowing, ugly voices, right? Not a nice voice. The reason Bel Canto is so different is because of the inhalation. Because most singers, 99.9% of singers, push. When you sing with Bel Canto, you inhale your voice. That is, as you're singing, you're drawing breath into your skull, which in turn creates a vacuum at the back of your throat and draws breath up out of your lungs. Rather than you pushing breath up out of your lungs, you're drawing breath up out of your lungs. And it's based on Brunelli's principle from science. Remember that? Science people class? Which means that it's like when you suck on a hose to siphon gas or water, whatever, right? You're creating a low pressure area, so high flows to low, and that's why the water comes out of the hose. So when you suck breath in your mouth, it creates a vacuum or a low pressure area at the back of your throat, which in turn draws in, this is important too, equal amounts of breath up out of your lungs. Okay, and why that's important is because it's the way you control your breath across the vocal cords when you sing. On high notes, which require more breath, you inhale more breath in your mouth, which in turn draws the same amount of breath from your lungs. But on low notes, which require less breath, you draw in less breath, which draws less breath from the lungs. Understand?
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. As a voiceover artist, we always were told, oh, use your diaphragm, you know, speak from your diaphragm.
What does that mean, though?
Speak from down here as opposed to...
What the hell does that mean? What, you're stuck out of your nuts? Well, what the fuck does that mean? No, I'm serious.
No,
what
that,
the hell does
point.
That mean?
No, yeah. My next question was going to be, as you're speaking to us in a speaking voice... Does Bel Canto have anything to do with the speaking voices, or it's strictly singing, Brian?
No, and you can use it for your talking voice too.
Okay.
If I left my throat like I am now, hear my voice get a higher timbre,
right?
Immediately,
right?
Yep. Because when you lift your throat, suddenly your voice can get forward off the hard palate. When you vibrate your voice off your hard palate, it has a much brighter sound to it. In fact, when I'm teaching students that are behind me, that's what I'm listening for. I don't look up from the keyboards. I can tell by the sound of the vowel. You only resonate a vowel. You can't resonate a T. A T is really...
Or
you can't make that bit long or short, good or bad.
Yeah.
You can only resonate the vowels. Those. A-E-I-O-U.
Yeah.
And the rest are bastardizations of those vowels. So... Bel Canto is based around resonating the vowels off the hard palate and making them, so you have to get your vowels open, which means your throat's up, right? And you have an open sound, which means really round, a round sound. It has to be focused, and it has to be inhaled. And you can tell whether it's inhaled, whether it has the overtones. So you can tell everything by the sound of the vowel. But it took me years and years and years to learn all this stuff. I went to Ed Johnson. I bet you I drove up there 15 years, up to Fergus every year. It took me a full day to go up there and back. And I did it religiously. I was the only one of everybody he taught that did that. There were several people that have been teachers from Ed, but none of them went back.
You followed through, is what you did.
Well, yeah, because if I wouldn't have done that, I would have never, it would have taken me a million years to understand how to teach it. It's one thing to learn it. It's quite another to teach it. Like I'd be sitting there at the piano going, I never had this problem in my voice, be looking at my student behind me, right, in the mirror, because I use a mirror to watch her face.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd go back week after week. I'd have a list of questions to ask. And eventually I learned how to be a proper teacher. But I probably would have been a teacher a lot faster if he would have said to me that to teach bel canto, you have to be an engineer. An engineer in a recording studio is a guy that sets the microphones and makes sure that the microphones get the sound that the producer's looking for. In the case of being an engineer in bel canto, when you're a teacher, you're listening to the sound of the vowel, not the microphone, but you listen to the sound of the vowel, and they have to do certain physical things or they won't be able to get that sound. It's as simple as that.
If we can loop back to the diaphragm, because your comment about the diaphragm, you said, what the hell is that, right?
Yeah, like I hear that all the time. The most ridiculous stuff. Sing for your diaphragm. I go, what the hell does that mean?
The idea is that you breathe from your abdomen. That's what I understand about the diaphragm is that, you know.
Well, you don't breathe through your abdomen either.
Ah, like, okay. So
your lungs haven't moved.
Okay, so there's movement up here for your lungs.
No, there's movement underneath your lungs.
Okay. So not necessarily your abdomen then.
When you learn how to do it properly, use your diaphragm, you got to learn it slow first.
Okay.
Yes, you're right from one aspect. It's like breathing out of your stomach. You're imagining breath that's going down to the bottom of your stomach.
Yeah.
Right.
But what's really happening is your diaphragm is going from that raised position into a lowered position. And when it does, because it's attached to the base of your lungs, it pulls your lungs downward and sucks your lungs full of air. Now, when you get that expansion in your midsection, it's because the diaphragm's going into a lowered position and pushing your internal organs in your midsection towards the abdominal walls. Now, at universities, though, what they teach them to do is to push out. I've even had students in that say, oh, yeah, my last voice teacher told me to push down like I was taking a good shit. I go, you're joking. Really? Like, it's baloney, though. And the reason that voice students listen to crap like that is because, A, if the person teaching you can sing with a good sound, a relatively good sound, you assume they know what they're talking about. Not true. Because if that was true, you wouldn't get people like Adele, Julie Andrews. Yeah. All these people are losing their voice. It's common as, you know, very common in the music industry to have singers losing their voice. And there's no reason for it if they'd learn how to sing properly.
So you attribute, obviously, bel canto to a lot of your success and keeping your voice.
I wouldn't be singing today. I wouldn't have been singing in 1983 when we got a record deal.
Brian, have you ever lost your voice over the years?
Many times. In the early days, we lost my voice a lot, yeah.
Was it a cold, or what do you equate that to?
You're improper singing. When I was over in Europe, it was when Chris first joined. I think it was 2014. That was it, 2014.
Yeah.
I sang the first 3 dates like a bird, and then I got so sick because I don't know what I got in Germany. We got to Hamburg, and I had to cancel. I woke up, and I was just coughing shit up, like, you know, I was coughing a lung up. But we turned around. We drove to Sweden from there, and by the time we got to Sweden, I was really sick. But you know what? Those days we couldn't cancel because they were like major cashola. And so I sang, and I thought, geez, I'm just barely getting by every night, right? And I listened to those tapes back, and I sound pretty damn good. So it just goes to show you that if you're singing properly, you can sing through colds and stuff like that. The only time you can't sing is when it affects your breathing.
Okay.
But, you know, if you got a sinus cold or that, you can sing through that stuff. I don't like doing it. Doesn't feel nice.
Nowadays, when you're doing these gigs and you do your hits, do you still enjoy singing your hits?
Yes.
Like, do you enjoy saying, give me an R? Or is it like, oh, shit, let's get through this so I can do other songs?
You have to approach it like it's the first time you played it, first time.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But we're going to change things up this year because it's the 40th anniversary of Walking the Razor's Edge.
Oh, okay.
So every time we go out, we change a few songs of the set. We keep the hits in because we think that's what the fans are coming to hear. So some artists don't do that. That's up to that artist, I guess. But, you know, we're not trying to break any artistic records here or anything. So we're playing the hits because that's what people come up to hear for us. And we throw in a couple songs maybe they haven't heard for a while. We were actually thinking of doing every gig, maybe doing one song we haven't done in a long time, filming it, and then putting that song aside. I just keep filming the song. So we get like a whole catalog of songs that we only have like maybe one take of.
Are they bringing in their sons and daughters?
Oh, yeah. They bring out the kids. A lot of times the kids are brought up in this music, and then they return to it. I tell you, classic rock is going to be around for a long time. And I tell people this, that it's largely because there's so much money now invested into classic rock music. And I mean, people like Bob Dylan, it's selling, what, $500 million for the catalog? Well, the people that bought Bob Dylan's catalog, they didn't do it for a hobby.
It's a business.
They did it to make money. Yeah. So you're going to hear Bob Dylan on every bloody commercial, soundtrack, cover song. Yeah. It's going to go on forever. And same thing with Steve Miller, Aerosmith, all these classic rock bands. Our catalog, we had basically three, four major hits in the United States. So who knows what our catalogs were. $100,000, $200,000, I don't know. But with time, it goes up.
Would you ever consider selling one of your songs for a commercial?
For sure. Why not?
Or have you?
Oh, I have. I've sold songs to...
Which one?
That 80s show. It was a prototype, of like a spinoff of that 70s show. We had a song in it.
Oh, I remember when they did that spinoff, yeah.
We had songs on... what was it? Degrassi High.
Oh, really? Oh.
On Iron Eagle 2, on First Born with Terry Garr, on several Trailer Park Boys shows, the movie.
Yes, right.
I don't know. There's lots of other stuff, too. I know there was a Native film out west. We had a, or not a Native movie, but it was a series. And then we had a song in it.
You've never allowed anybody to use your songs for products. Like, you never use, like, give me an R to sell mayonnaise or something.
No, but if I they give me the money, well, why not?
Ah, okay.
I'm not going to sell out to the mayonnaise people. Fuck that. I don't need that 60 grand.
Yeah.
Damn those mayonnaise people. I hate them. They're trying to buy me out.
Those damn mayonnaise people. My God.
Well, we had a song out of Labatt's beer. That was a big swallow back in the day.
Yes, I remember that.
And then they put out Heavy Metal Love. It was Heavy Metal Blue. what else? They wanted us for something else, too. Where we drew the line, though, was on a no smoking commercial. We went, oh, come on, we all smoke. That's like one time I was at doing an interview with Lemmy during the Reagan era and, you know, say no to drugs.
Oh. Yes.
No!
Yeah.
No, I won't say that. Anyway, I'm in there with Lemmy, and the program director comes in. He goes, he says, I want you to do an anti-drug commercial when you're done. I thought, what's Lemmy going to say? He does like lines of crystal meth like this deep. Lemmy didn't bat an eye. He grabbed the mic. He says, oh, this is Lemmy, kids. Oh, I'll tell you, all you kids are thinking of doing drugs all day. That. Kids, don't do drugs. All my friends that done drugs are either dead or they're going to die. So don't do drugs. Oh, that was the best anti-drug commercial I ever heard. I probably scared the shit right out of the kids, you know. I am grieving here, and you know, it seems really different not having Fritz around.
Yeah.
It's going to seem strange. I think for a long time, I had another really close friend, Jay Wetlaufer. ironically, I wrote a song with, well, the rest of the guys called Brother from a Different Mother.
Aww.
And it was about Jay, but I think I'm going to release it in memory of both Jay and Fritz, although Fritz didn't ride a bike.
Yeah.
And it kind of refers to motorcycle riding in the song. But yeah, I should release that. Anyway, I got to go.
Thanks, Brian.
Once again, Helix, along with Honeymoon Suite at the Arcadia Theater in Charles, Illinois. That's coming up on May 11th, 2024. And with Alda Nova on May 18th at the River Cree Resort and Casino in Alberta.
Well, I really enjoyed that interview.
He,
We've been trying to get Brian on the show for a long time.
Yeah, right? But Brian, one thing you'll have to know about Brian is Brian is a very, very busy guy. Mm-hmm. We talk quite regularly, but it just seems every time I get him on the phone, like I said, he's in the middle of a walk or something like that. But you know what? The neat thing about Brian is he always finds time for me. And with everything that's happened in the last year, it was really good to have him on the program.
I imagine he was very supportive when you lost your son. You're able to talk to Brian, and I'm sure, you know, with the losses in his band and his personal life, I'm sure that he would understand how you feel.
Deep cuts the knife.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to like and follow us on all social media. And if you like what you hear, hit subscribe, download, and share with your friends. Thanks. Mind Body Matters is a Great Media production.